First of all, I want to thank all of you for being here this morning. For those of us from the east, the northeast, we got out of a little bit of snow, right? And so I expected my weather travel plans yesterday to be disrupted in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, or maybe Chicago, but I didn't expect that last night I couldn't land here in Southern California because of rain. Because apparently the runway is too short in Santa Ana for a 737. And so they rerouted us because of weight. They rerouted us to Ontario, California, put us on a bus and took us down to Santa Ana. And I laughed because when I got to when the guy came on the plane from American Airlines, and they were wonderful, they were really gracious, but he came on and he said, "Well, it's raining out there. Stay in the baggage claim area, we'll tell you when it's safe." So I want to start by telling you that I am extraordinarily proud to be a family physician. And this, in my opinion, is one of the highest callings that any profession. I mean, how many times do you see a discipline where we like each other, we celebrate each other, and we take care of just about everyone who walks in our door? That's not the case for many of our specialty colleagues, but I've witnessed something over the last 5.5 years at AAFP, in my years as board chair and president and on the board. And that is that I think we need to rethink our message a little bit. We're nice guys, generally. We kind of like most of the rotations that we're on. We like to just take care of, we're people for the most part. And that's a really good thing. But I don't think we celebrate it enough. And I don't think we project it enough to our medical community. It fascinates me. As recently as last night in the car, my driver said to me, he said, "Well, what kind of physician are you?" And I said, "Family medicine." "Well, what is that?" And I hear that question quite a bit. And it's changing, but it's not changing fast enough. And I sit on the board of a community bank at home, and one of my our employees are. It's another way that I can build the health of a community and make sure that their loan portfolio includes those people who need it, who need the dollars for some of their public health work. So one of the men who works there said to me, he said, "Well, my daughter just graduated from medical school. I've known her since she was a little girl." He said, "But she's only going into primary care." And I said, "Michael, she's going into primary care. There's no only about it." And he said, "Oh, no, Wanda, I'm sorry." I said, "So I want to share some of the information with you that I've learned. I'm going to ask us to think about our strategy and begin to message from a position of power and from a position that we are unabashedly proud of what it is that we do for this country and what we do for our patients, and recognize that we are not a safety choice. We are not the last resort for the student who couldn't find a residency in something else. Frankly, I don't want those people. I only want the people who are willing to take care of the whole person, who are able to manage complex information, who are not there only for the dollars, but are there for the people, who are willing to engage in their community writ large. And I will say that at medical schools. Interestingly, I was at one of the DC medical schools, and there was a whole group of students there. And I've been to a lot of medical schools around the country in the last couple years. And a group of these students had just come for lunch. And we all know that scenario. You know, they had one of those really giant big subs, and they were cutting off pieces of the sub. And these guys were in the back of the room, and they were pretty disengaged. And as soon as I said, "I don't want you if you can't," they sat up. Because we need to show that family medicine is something that you aspire to, that you compete for, that family medicine is the ultimate career in American healthcare. And I will tell you that right now, family physicians do 200 million office visits a year. That's 1 in 5 office visits. Far and away, the highest number of patient care visits in this country. And it's made us a force to be reckoned with. The White House has known it, the administration knows it, state legislators know it, because we are about the only discipline that can deliver on the triple aim. And are you all familiar with the triple aim? improving care for the individual, improving the health of the community at a lower cost. We're about the only discipline that really can do that and do it well. And I think that sometimes we've been beaten down. And by show of hands, and I'll include myself in this, how many of you were told you're too smart to go into family medicine? Look around the room. Keep your hands up. That's unprofessional. For people to tell you that is highly unprofessional. The students are still hearing that crap today. Now, the flip side of that, interestingly, is now what I also hear is there's too much to know. And as I go around, many of the things that the students will tell me, they're fears. They have a lot of questions. And we need to be very proud to talk about the fact that we stand in a career that services one out of every five U.S. office visits. And that when you add a family physician to the community, the only discipline that will do that, when you add a family physician to a community, the mortality actually drops. When you add some of the specialists to the community, guess what happens to the mortality? Guess what happens to the cost? Now, for those of you that are family physicians, how many of you have said to a patient, I really don't think you need to have this procedure done? Sometimes it's what we tell people, it's not only what we do to them or the pills that we give them, and we know that. But America is just awakening to this reality that healthcare has bankrupted this country in many ways. And so much of our GDP is going to healthcare that could be spent on other usable social determinants of health, education, housing, food security, so many other things that actually make our country more healthy. What I find from this current crop of medical students is they are very socially minded, and I love that. 31% of all U.S. medical students are members of the American Academy of Family Physicians. 31%. Now, for years, the Academy used to say, we're working on student interest. Well, you know what? We've got student interest. This is a group of students that get it. They understand the needs to change American healthcare. But they don't always understand why we are the instrument to make that happen. And that's where I would ask you to begin to share some of this information, again, in this celebratory manner, and talk about the opportunity. I like to position family medicine to medical students as what I call the pluripotential career. And I think about it, my joke is if you've met one family physician, you've met one family physician. And family medicine, we have a workforce. The American Academy of Family Physicians, including the students, is just shy of 125,000 members. Activating and deploying these members around the country to change American healthcare, to get our students, our residents, our faculty, our private practicing physicians engaged in a lot of the work that we can do can change the face of American healthcare. So when I talk to the students, they have frequently a lot of misperceptions. They are worried about the complexity, and they're sure that it's not manageable. And then I point out to them that we do 200 million office visits a year, and that there are tens of thousands of us doing this, and we can teach them how to do that. We do it all the time. The people in this room do it all the time. We can teach you to manage the complexity. It's totally doable. That seems to jump over the first barrier. The second barrier that I often find is the issue of respect. And so what I say to them is, let me explain something to you. If you're training in an academic medical center and you're not seeing rank and file family physicians all the time, one of the things that you need to understand is I can pick up the phone and call the orthopedic surgeon and say, I want you to know that I'm not sending another patient to you. And when they ask why, you say, because this is what you said to my patient, or this is how you treated them, and my patients deserve better from you. And what they say to me is, sorry, Dr. Filer, thanks for letting me know. We will take care of this. Please keep me in your referral file. Or I make the decision when we're going to do a procedure that I mentioned, my 88-year-old patient who came in and was told he needed his knee replaced. His knee that was allowing him to walk up and down his stairs quite easily and get to his workshop. And he's in chronic atrial fib with a little bit of CHF on the side. And I said, no, I would not wreck exactly. No, I don't want you to do this. Well, he told me I had to. And I said, because he didn't know how to tell you not to. You kept going back and he didn't know what else to do. He said, but he's hoping against hope that I will tell you what I'm telling you now. And the medical students understand that, but they didn't realize that family physicians have that kind of leverage and authority. Anybody here from Toledo? So about 3 weeks ago, I am proud to tell you, and I said something to this table back there. About 3 weeks ago, I was on getting on an airplane from Florida to go wherever I was going next. And I got a text message from Dr. Kim Yu in Michigan. And some of you may know Kim. She's like the social media queen. And she said, Wanda, I hear that one of the Toledo programs, a 30-year history, very, very strong program, the hospital has made a decision to close it. Guess what? Family medicine activated. I sent out a couple of emails. The residents and some of the alumni from that residency program activated. The next thing you knew, we had two of the largest employers in the state of Ohio calling that hospital administration. The governor's office called that hospital administration. The media called that hospital administration. And I think we're at, and we worked in out in the public arena to force that issue, because quite frankly, this, as you know, residency programs often do care for patients who have difficulty getting care elsewhere. And that was clearly the case in this particular stand-up residency program. In the meantime, we worked behind the scenes and said, what can we do to help this program, to help, most importantly, those residents, and then think about continuity. Because we know that once those residency slots are lost to some other discipline, they're really hard to get them back. So we cannot lose residency slots in family medicine. We need way more residency slots in family medicine these days, and we need the faculty to man them up, as you know. But right now, what happened is that hospital has said, I think they had no idea. And one of the chief residents sent me, and I think it was a chief, she sent me an email, or maybe an alum, and said, thank you for everything you've done. They had no idea what kind of family medicine forces would be unleashed upon them. The social media world was going crazy, and they were outing the fact that this particular health system was building a brand new hospital for its cardiology tower, but they were walking away from the people in greatest need. The specialty community in Toledo came forward to the administration and said, what do you think you're doing? Where do you think we get our patients from? That kind of power is the power that the students need to be hearing about. They need to understand the critical difference we make. You know, there's data that I've seen that suggests that for all of those RVUs that we so lovingly detest, for those patient visits we get, and they try to account for how many, you know, the dollars that you bring into a system, it's actually a multiplier of at least 7. By the time you look at the other things that we do in a system, when they include blood work and x-rays and behavioral health and all of the other work that we do, the multiplier effect to a hospital. And the hospitals that have walked away from family medicine often do not do as well financially in the fairly short term. And so how do we make sure that the medical students know that when they join family medicine, they join a winning team? They're not joining a team that is too smart to go into family medicine or there's too much to know. We are not the safety choice. We are the pluripotential STEM career. And, you know, you heard a little bit about my CV there. I've done a lot of kind of funky things in my life. I take care of patients at a federally qualified health center where they probably speak about 20 languages. I taught the procedure curriculum in a residency program, so I can take off your toenail. I can do your pap smear. I can manage your depression, your type 2 diabetes. I just would prefer not to do them all in one visit. Two weeks ago, I was in San Diego at the Cancer Survivorship Conference. I have a particular affinity for cancer issues. It's a passion of mine, and as you heard, I served as president of the American Cancer Society. Again, pluripotential opportunities, because as family physicians, we are very community engaged. And at this cancer survivorship meeting, there were about 900 people there, and AAFP was one of the co-sponsors, along with ACP and ASCO, the American Society of Clinical Oncology. And actually, the whole curriculum for the day was put together by Dr. Kevin Effinger, for those of you who might know him. Kevin's a family physician who runs the cancer survivorship program at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Pluripotential career. Then I talked to my friend Rich Wender. Any of you know Rich Wender? Rich was the department chair at Jefferson for 30 years. Rich interviewed me for residency because I was morphing. I actually matched in general surgery because I was too smart to go into family medicine. And I was too bored in general surgery. And so I interviewed with Rich, and I went to one of their affiliate programs in South Jersey. Rich Wender is now the chief medical officer of the American Cancer Society in Atlanta. He's a family physician. I was, when we were there, the, I'm blanking on his last name, Lewis MD Anderson Cancer Center. Lewis Foxhall. CEO and at MD Anderson, one of the preeminent cancer centers in the country, family physician. The CEO of my health system, which is now 5 assorted hospitals in South Central Pennsylvania, was a fellow faculty member with me. He's a family physician. You look at people like Regina Benjamin, former Surgeon General of the U.S. There are ways. And then I look at the people like the woman that I met in Wisconsin. The woman who came in, and she was going to be the family physician of the year for Wisconsin, and she came in with her turban on because of her alopecia that was chemotherapy-induced. And she's also the medical director of the hospice, does shifts in the emergency department, does C-sections, has her own private practice. And who nominated her? Her entire community. And many of them were at that award ceremony that night because what they said is, she has taken care of us so well and for so long, we want to give back to her. And it was an extraordinary moment. We have one of our young emerging leaders, a woman who's a resident and part of the Emerging Leaders Program through the American Academy Foundation. And the foundation has this Emerging Leaders Program. And this young woman is actually in, I think she may have just come back, but she went to Africa. And they had some ultrasound machines that they took to Africa last year. And they taught the nurse midwives in Uganda to use ultrasound. Never something that they had available again. Taught them the antenatal uses of ultrasound. They went back, and her advisor was Dr. Sarah Sams from Ohio. And Sarah sent me an email on this because they were looking for money to support these ultrasound costs. And I said, Sarah, how about if you both become also instructors? And so this resident and two more residents then and Sarah became also instructors, and they also did the Helping Babies Breathe course, and they are back over there, as well as midwives that they've brought in from Afghanistan. Family medicine can change the face of healthcare in our communities, in our country, but we need it to start at the medical school level. We need the students to have enthusiastic, positive preceptors, and I know that that can be sometimes difficult. But we know that last week I was in Kansas City. I do get home once in a while, by the way. I was in Kansas City last week, and I listened to our Family Medicine Interest Group National Coordinator, a young woman who's a medical student, and she said the worst thing that can happen to any student is to get a negative family medicine preceptor. And so they're worried about the complexity. They're worried about the respect. They're worried about are they going to see positive or negative attitudes? Things for you to think about. If positive attitudes and showing folks that they are joining a winning team goes a long way. Interestingly enough, one of the other issues that I hear about is the finances. An awful lot of medical students told me they assumed that most family physicians make $50,000 a year. I heard that a lot. What's that? That's what they did as a resident. Yeah, there you go, as a resident. And that's what they told me. I mean, I've heard that from multiple medical schools, and I don't know where that number comes from. So I tell them, the Medscape data, which suggests about 225,000, and their mouths drop open. Because, yes, they are burdened with significant student debt. All medical students are. But debt really does not seem to be the critical determinant of whether they're going to choose a primary care career. It's what they've seen. It's what they've been exposed to. It's wanting to go to a career to which they can aspire. They want to be on the winning team. I tell them about loan forgiveness. I tell them about, family medicine is the number one job opportunity being recruited in American medicine 11 years running. That if you are a family physician, you will never be without a job. You can write your ticket. You can, if you don't like this job, believe me, there are many more for which you will be well suited and you will find the place that's home for you. And that sense of energy and enthusiasm really very much resonates. Another big thing that I hear from the students is the concern about work-life balance. And this idea that, and even last week at the ASCO Cancer Survivorship Meeting, all those people in the room, they heard from the American College of Physicians president, and then they heard from me, and they really didn't understand. I said, folks, let me tell you what family physicians do. We do house visits. We take off your toenail. We treat your depression, your coronary artery disease. And no, I don't want you to transition a cancer patient back to me. I want to be there with them along the way. And I told concrete examples of patients who could have had better outcomes had we been able to work together along the way. They had no idea. They didn't know we do all that stuff. What they knew is that they didn't want to send them back to us because they knew we were already overburdened and they were afraid that they were overtaxing us. And I said, you need to understand these are people I've taken care of for 15, 20, 25 years. I got to speak at my one patient's funeral. I'm the one who called oncology and said he wants to be done, but he doesn't know how to tell you because you're fighting for him. But he is so ready to be done. And made a house visit the night before he passed away. They had no idea. The medical students worry about this because, like all of us, they want to be all in. And how can we also have time for family? And so what I share with them is my perspective as a woman in medicine who's also a wife, a mother of two daughters, has done a lot of other stuff, as you've heard, and talk to them about the opportunity to recognize that being a family physician is the backbone of you, who you are. But it doesn't necessarily define what your career is going to look like. It's a training and a mindset that you take forward to serve the health of this nation. And you can do that, and that means that when I did a presentation in Pennsylvania to the health department on interpersonal violence, which is something that I've done for 25 years, it was Take Your Daughter to Work Day, and my daughter was 12, and I brought her with me. And I said to her, Becky, you need to understand, this is going to be a very, very difficult talk. And you're 12 years old, and there's things I need to tell these people that are going to be really hard for you to hear. I want to know if you still want to do this. And she sat there as I did my presentation on domestic violence and talked about the murder of an entire family of my patients and the things that I have seen as I've traveled around the country for the last 25 years talking about improving healthcare response for domestic violence. As we finished, she came up to me afterward and she said, you know, Mommy, what you do is important, isn't it? And I said, yes, sweetheart, I think it is. Okay, you can keep doing it. And I talked about the importance of having support and the importance of having a spouse, a significant other, a loved one, a family who understands that you love your work, that you're passionate about your work, that we don't say, I have to go to work. You say, I'm going to work or I want to go to work. Have to go to work sounds like it's a barrier that you've got to just, it's drudgery, I've got to do it. How do we talk about our lives? And I talk about the importance of having a very supportive partner, and which I have. I'm totally blessed. And again, that seems to reassure many of the medical students. There are personal, financial, career issues, as you know, that these students are wrestling with. I think the fact that I'm a woman, I've got, you know, two children, you can do this. If you need to go back and you work part-time for a while, that's absolutely fine. You do what you need to do. We're in a discipline that supports it. And also, if the place that I'm working with says we're not going to make it work, guess what? Number one job opportunity, 11 years running. And the students find significant interest in that. We talk about the opportunity to do research. Many of them have an interest in research. They didn't know that was an option in primary care. And so I've been fascinated as I go around to find that we are often giving students some facts, but we forget to give them our passion. And sometimes we give them our passion, but we forget to give them the facts. And I think that marriage of data and what this unstoppable force in American medicine is an opportunity that we can all reinvigorate. And I will tell you that you remember a few years ago when we all wanted flu shots and there weren't enough, and all those people this year were trying to talk them into flu shots. That year they were lined up to get them. It's the scarcity principle. Things are more valuable when you can't get them. students, when I said to those students in D.C., I don't want you if you're not going to do this and this, they sat up and took notice. This is not a safety choice. I only want you if you are committed to lifelong learning. I only want you if you're going to take care of the whole person, if you're capable of taking care of more than one organ system. You're going to be a comprehensivist. We're going to do comprehensive, continuous, coordinated, first contact care, the four C's of primary care. But I would submit to you that family medicine is also about community, compassion, and there's another C that I had and I can't remember what it was. There's a lot of things that we are being called upon to do right now, and there's a reason for that. We tend to be very system savvy. We know that when you push here, sometimes this goes out of control. We see it all the time. You know, you increase an ACE inhibitor, a little bit better from their heart failure, and their renal function takes a hit. Or their potassium client, you know, whatever the issue is. We know that push and pull. That multi-system thinking and ability to deal with uncertainty and to deal with complexity positions us extraordinarily well for leadership. For leadership in our health systems, for leadership in our states, for leadership in government. And it is a skill set that is not easily transferable. And so when we talk about the opportunity of family medicine, you can do public health. You know, you can do research, you can do direct patient care, you can do emergency care, you can do hospitalists, you can deliver babies, you can do, you know, C-sections, you can do palliative care, you can do sports medicine, you can do whatever. We know the incredible universe that is family medicine. The students don't. And so what I would ask you to do is to begin to speak from a position of power. Not just passion, but from a position to say, this is how we are a movement, and we are changing American healthcare, and we are here to do that. We do that with FAM-MedPAC. We got just over $1 million in this last political campaign, and we got doors open that never were opened even 5 years ago. It's unbelievable to watch the difference. And it's not about buying a vote. It's about having access and saying family medicine has grown up. And we get it, and they're taking the world seriously. It's about doing the research, the health systems research, to show the value. That data is out there in droves now to show the power of primary care. At the cancer meeting 2 weeks ago, they had one of the presentations. I tried to get it, but it's not been published yet, so we wouldn't share it. He shared it publicly there. But he showed that the patients who were getting cancer care from a purely oncology team and what their survivals look like. And then the cancer care where primary care was integrated in lockstep along the way. The patients, and probably not a surprise to people in this room, those people in the audience at the cancer meeting were flabbergasted to find out that the adding primary care improved life expectancy and it lowered cost. That data is out there across multiple systems beyond oncology. And I sat in a meeting at the Brookings Institute about a year ago with the American College of Cardiology, and they were kind of dissing, I learned that word from my kids, they were dissing patient-centered medical home. And there was this one study done in Philadelphia on this old model and blah, blah, blah. And I said, wait a minute, you're picking on one study on an old model. Let me show you the 200 plus studies that show how coordinated, transformed primary care works and the impact we can have in this country. Oh, well, we didn't know. Right now, we know there's a shift to value-based payment. Value-based payment done properly can very much be a benefit for this country and for primary care. This country only spends right now, depends on where you look, but maybe 5-7% of its healthcare dollar. So 5-7% on every healthcare dollar is spent in primary care. The countries that do it right spend 15-25 cents. In Rhode Island, when they upped their spend on primary care, because of legislation, and they went up to 10 to 11%, the amount of money that was earmarked for primary care rose significantly, and the total spend on health care in Rhode Island dropped, while their population quality indicators improved. So a lot of our work, and this, again, is a message I'd like you to carry out there, it's time for change in this country. We need to spend more of our health care dollar on primary care because, frankly, it's a smarter investment. It's a smarter investment than doing a knee replacement on an 88-year-old. and causing harm to him, and many of the other things that you've all raised your hands about. The students need to know that they are part of a movement. We're about change. We're about getting better health care, getting the health care that this country deserves at a better price point, and then allowing those monies to go to the other things that are social determinants of health. I want you to know it has been an absolute privilege. I've got a few months left as board chair. It's been an amazing privilege to get to meet my colleagues all over this country and to see the work that they're doing, sometimes under amazing adverse circumstances, and yet they do it, for the most part, with joy. There's a few. They're probably precepting. And you know, I worked with a colleague who I loved dearly. He was a superb physician, but his personality was more the Archie Bunker kind of. But he was the man that when I left him for the day, I'd go on vacation, and I knew Bill was there to take care of people. So thank you for all that you do, and we'll open for questions if you'd like.